Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, the Young Professionals Division of the Commonwealth Club, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. My name is Adam Yamaguchi. I am correspondent and executive producer for Current TV's Vanguard series and your moderator for the evening. Just a quick note about Current TV. Current TV is a cable network that was founded by Al Gore and Joel Hyatt and is the home, the future home of the Keith Olbermann Show. Sorry, I had to get that in real quickly. Sorry. He's my new boss, so got to please him. Tonight, we're lucky to have a very large and diverse set of panelists to discuss the revolution in Egypt and the recent groundbreaking developments in the Middle East and North Africa. But before we introduce them all, let's go quickly to our first panelist, Ayman Moyodin, correspondent for Al Jazeera English, who is Skyping in from the ground in his apartment in Cairo. Ayman is going to kick us off by giving us a brief overview of the important happenings of the last couple weeks. Thank you so much for joining us, Ayman. If you want to get us started with a few moments, with a few updates.
Great. Well, thank you very much for having me participate in this. You know, it was very similar technology to what we're using right now, in fact, that allowed Al Jazeera to broadcast really almost uninterrupted for the 18 days of the Egyptian Revolution, which I think is safe to say, you know, has made history all around the world, because indeed what we've seen over the past several weeks indeed was a historic revolution on so many fronts, not just simply on the political front, but also for us as journalists in terms of how we use technology, the role the internet played, the role social media websites played, and indeed all of that really came to light in Egypt. In fact, one of the running jokes right now, and I'm going to throw it out here, I hope everyone can hear it, was when President Hosni Mubarak, you know, goes to heaven, he sees his two predecessors, the former Egyptian president Anwar Sadat and Gamal Abdel Nasser, and he asks, am I at heaven? Gamal Abdel Nasser says, yes, you're here, but tell us, how did you die? Was it an assassination or a poisoning like us? And he turns around and says, no, it was Facebook that led him to... that led to his ultimate downfall. I'm going to start off just by telling you guys where Egypt stands today, and then, you know, if time permits and you guys would like to ask some questions, I can certainly be glad to answer a few. I mean, right now it's 5 a.m. local time, and we're just a few hours away, actually, from one of the biggest challenges Egypt has faced since the end of the revolution. And the reason why I say that is because it has been a very tumultuous week here in Egypt. I think Egypt is waking up slowly to its post-euphoria hangover, so to speak. And there are some very tough questions that the society now has to begin to answer. Now, what is very different is that some of these questions that Egyptians have to answer have to look at themselves and have to look at what role they, as Egyptians, have played in allowing this system, this regime to exist for the past 30 years, and where are some of those fault lines that for so many years had been ignored or people knew existed but did nothing about them. This week was a week that saw some sectarian clashes in an Egyptian village just south of Cairo that quickly spread to other parts of the city. And unfortunately, as a result, there were about 13 Egyptians killed, 7 of them Coptic Christians, and 6 that were Muslims. And that happened in clashes in various parts across the city as the Christian community was protesting what they've described as, over the years, discrimination. So why this Friday is so important? Well, immediately the following day after those protests happened, the Egyptian military went into Tahrir Square, which I think all of us have now recognized as this iconic center of the Egyptian revolution, the gathering of the people's call for freedom, and they essentially cleared it out with force. They essentially something they had not done previously to this extent, walked in and ripped up all the tents, ripped down all the signs, and arrested about 200 or so protesters that had been doing what they did from the very beginning, which was peaceful demonstration. So we're just a few hours away. It's Friday. This revolution, so to speak, began on Friday, January the 28th, when they called the second day of anger. And it was that Friday that essentially millions of people took to the streets, overwhelmed the police and the state security force, and managed to essentially take control of Tahrir Square. And we're going to see today, hopefully, whether or not the Egyptian people respond to this week's events in the same kind of positive attitude, peaceful attitude, or whether we are going to see some of that momentum that had been gained over the past several weeks die down a little bit. The situation in general in Egypt remains to be very precarious. It is a situation where the country takes two steps forward, one step back. The most important deadline coming up, or the most important timeline coming up, is just a few days away, and that is on March 19th. Egyptians will go to the polls for what they're hoping will be a free and fair referendum on whether or not to accept 8 constitutional amendments that essentially limit the power of the presidency. Now, a lot of people, including prominent opposition figures like Mohammed al-Baradei and others, oppose these amendments because they don't think the problem in Egypt is a simple amendment here or there or a tweak in the language, but a overhaul of the entire constitutional system and the system of governance. So that is certainly an important test as well coming up for Egyptians on the 19th. The Supreme Council of the Armed Forces of Egypt, which is essentially running the country, is definitely under strain. It is in a position it has made very clear that it does not want to be in, and they want to accelerate, if you will, the position of handing over the reins of power to a democratically elected government within 6 months. Now, on the surface, that looks good, but the problem is Egypt is a country that for 30 years was ruled almost by one man in a system of power monopolized by him. And the institutions of this state, while they do exist on paper, have not been very functional. The question is, can in these 6 months you galvanize people to participate in politics, to give them time to organize themselves, and to allow for the state's institutions to build the mechanisms that allow for free and fair elections. So certainly on the political front, Egypt also is moving along slowly. The good news comes from the appointment for the first time of a, although not democratically elected, but an individual chosen by the revolution. And why I say that is because Dr. Assam Sharaf, the newly appointed prime minister, was a name that was actually put forth by the revolutionary groups, the January 25th revolutionary groups, and other members of the opposition. So what you have here for the first time in the history of Egypt, again, while not democratically elected by the ballot box, the military essentially saying to the people of Egypt, who do you want to rule you? And this is the name the vast majority of the groups put forth. So we are still in a very delicate political situation, and it will be very important to watch how this situation unfolds in the coming day. I just want to say very briefly also, you know, when people talk, there's been a lot of discussion about whether this should be called a Twitter revolution or a Facebook revolution. There's no doubt that, to put it lightly, this has been an information revolution, and the power of information has been a important catalyst in mobilizing people to the streets. These tools of the revolution, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, allowed for people to actually share with themselves and condense the space and time that exists between cities, between villages, and essentially between countries. Because when we start to talk about the Egyptian revolution on January the 25th, nobody can deny that what happened in a small village in Tunisia on December 17th was essentially a catalyst. And nobody would have recognized what happened in Egypt on January the 28th when Egyptians took over Tahrir Square without acknowledging that on December 17th when a man named Mohamed Bouazizi took to a small village after, you know, suffering a great deal of indignity and inhumanity in his life, set himself on fire and essentially became the catalyst. Now, how do you go from that small village in southwest Tunisia all the way to the capital of Cairo, now to Bahrain, to Yemen, to Libya? And it's with the power of information that that catalyst can spread across the Arab world so rapidly. I'm not a big fan of the terms Facebook or Twitter revolution, but I am the first person to acknowledge that these revolutions could not have happened in the space and time that they are happening in had it not been for the power of information. So I hope just to have given you guys a bit overview of what the situation is in Egypt, and I'll be glad to take some questions from you.
Ayman, thank you so much for that update. We actually have a pretty large panel tonight, and we've got a lot to get through. So you've given us a lot of great discussion points for us to chew on. So we're going to, sorry to end this Skype session here, but we're going to get right to it. So thank you so much for joining us. I know it's very, very early where you are, so hope you get some...
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Now let's get to our guests in person. Starting right here to my left is Jamal Dajani. He is the Vice President of the Middle East, North Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean at the Internews Network. Prior to this, he was the Vice President of International News at Link TV, where he co-created Mosaic, World News from the Middle East. To his left, Stephen Zunis is Professor of Politics and International Studies, as well as Chair of the Middle Eastern Studies Program at the University of San Francisco. He's authored and edited several books, including Tinderbox and Nonviolent Social Movements. Moving down, Chris Taylor is the San Francisco Bureau Chief at Mashable. Prior to this, he was West Coast Editor of FastCompany.com, West Coast Editor for Fortune Small Business, and the San Francisco Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. Chris recently authored the article, Why Not Call It a Facebook Revolution? moving down, Dan Williams is the Senior Emergencies Researcher at Human Rights Watch. Dan was detained and jailed for 36 hours in Cairo during the initial protests in early February. Dan was previously a foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, and Bloomberg News, and has covered the Middle East for the past decade. And finally, we have Noor Ahmadine. He's a senior at the University of San Francisco, and he was born and raised in Cairo. Noor is currently completing his degree in international studies with an emphasis in peace and conflict studies at a Middle Eastern studies regional track. He is currently a member of the newly founded student group, YALA, Students in Solidarity. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Yeah, you did.
So now that we've met our speakers, let's get started. So I'm going to direct my first question to Jamal Dajani. Someone who works in Internews, part of your job is to work with local media partners. And, you know, it seems as though the local presses or the citizen journalist movement and everyday ordinary citizens played a pretty prominent role in getting the visuals and the words out there. Tell us a little bit about how this all started, how the word got out in Tunisia.
Thank you for hosting me here. This is my fourth time at the Commonwealth Club. I was fortunate to come here when we first launched Mosaic almost 10 years ago. But you're right. I was actually in Tunisia at the end of December, shortly after that unemployed graduate who set himself on fire. And when I was there, I was surprised about December 29th, watching Tunisian television and other local networks there. There were no reports of whatsoever about what happened in Sidi Bouzid. I mean, people in Tunis, just a few miles away, were not able to watch the news in a town just a few miles away from the capital. They learned about the news through social media. They learned about the news from Facebook, Twitter. They learned about the news from satellite TV that wasn't broadcast from their own country. And something very important Ayman said about the power of information. When I started in this business as far as launching Mosaic 10 years ago, there were 200 satellite stations at that time. Today, you have more than 750 satellite networks covering the news in the region. So if you don't watch the news internally, you have other options by watching Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, and others. So most of the news, but the ministers of information try to censor by controlling their own networks. They failed because they had other sources. And so if it wasn't Twitter at one point, it was satellite TV. If it wasn't satellite television, it was Facebook. And it spread like wildfire, I would say, by January 1st, everyone in Tunis knew about what happened, and they started what started in Sidi Bouzid moved quickly to the capital, and we started seeing crowds assembling there at the Kasbah, which was basically a couple of blocks away from the ministries and the government houses, and that's how it spread.
Okay, now I'm going to open this question up to the group here. Tunisia, the events in Tunisia are widely credited as have being the catalyst for what would happen about a month later in Egypt. There are some who say, though, that really what happened in Egypt was, or what ended up happening in Egypt was long, long in the making. So what exactly set the region ablaze?
In many ways, what we saw in Egypt has been a continuation of what we've seen in many parts of the world for the past few decades, from the Philippines to Poland, from Chile to Czechoslovakia, you know, from the Maldives to Mali. This phenomenon of nonviolent, largely nonviolent civil insurrections for democracy. And there's been episodes in the Middle East. I mean, you can go back to the 1919 Egyptian Revolution for independence from Britain. But, we've seen a revolution in Lebanon, the ouster of Namerre in Sudan in 1985, though tragically that was reversed in a military coup a few years later. But this it's part of a global phenomenon, and it was only a matter of time before it came to the Middle East. And in Egypt, civil society has been burgeoning in that country for a number of years. I actually did a workshop on strategic nonviolent action at the Ibn Khaldun Center in Cairo a few years ago. And I was some press reports, because we brought in some people from Otpor and from Serbia and from the UDF in South Africa and others, that somehow this was contributed to the uprising. But in fact, what we found was that these folks had already been thinking about these issues, and they were, I wrote an article in early December, right after the Egyptian parliamentary election, that Egypt would probably be the next country that would have a nonviolent pro-democracy movement, like we've seen in places like Serbia and the Philippines. Well, I was wrong, because Tunisia beat them to it. But I do think this had been coming. And while I think Tunisia was something of a spark that helped make it happen when it did, I think it was only a matter of time, perhaps if Mubarak had formally passed on the mantle to Gamal or something, to his son as predictor, something would have triggered it, I think, in the coming months or year or so, even without what happened in Tunisia. That was certainly a major inspiration for the Egyptians and for others.
Still, Stephen, for all this, it was coming. Mm-hmm. There was something mystical about the event in Tunisia that really transcends even the way it was carried by Facebook or Al Jazeera and so on. This man's self-sacrifice is something mythic, and it's difficult to even to grasp the effect it had on young people who were very much like him. And I think everyone's forgetting that his sacrifice, self-sacrifice, was repeated in Algeria, in Egypt, and I forgot maybe some other places, it became a kind of individual sacrifice to the gods that touched people. I can't explain this, but there was something mystical about it as well. I thought it was going to take some sort of Chernobyl event in Egypt to set off the masses. Instead, though, this one act, self-sacrificial thing, did it.
Dan, are you suggesting here that that people were inspired by the actions?
Yes, there's no question they were inspired, because in Tunisia, the demonstrations began in December. The government didn't respond with lethal force until early January, when it was clear they weren't going to stop. But in Tunisia, the demonstrations began after this guy's sacrifice became known and spread from town to town in the interior of the country and eventually to the coast. What was doubly interesting about Tunisia and also in Egypt, the more the government started using bullets, the more determined they came. There's this self-sacrifice of this gentleman infected the entire society to them being, the bullets didn't work. And they didn't work in Egypt.
To the region.
Well, but they didn't work in Egypt. They didn't work anywhere. Mm-hmm. Again, I can't explain it. Now, Muammar Gaddafi's using more bullets and more bombs than any did, and maybe he can find the formula to stop this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's take a minute to come back to social media, because I think this is a topic that everyone here on this panel has quite a few opinions about. Much has been made about the role that Facebook has played, and I'm going to toss this question to Chris Taylor, who, of course, penned the article, Why Not Call This a Facebook Revolution? And I'm sure Stephen will have quite a few comments to add to that after that. So, Chris?
Well, I want to say at the outset, I'm no cheerleader for Facebook. I'm not here representing them. Mashable writes a lot about Facebook and about social media in general. But we write about the good and the bad. Here in the U.S., we're well aware of the privacy issues. We're well aware of the productivity issues and how much of a time suck it could be. But I think we forget, you know, this is 500 million people and counting are on Facebook. If the trend lines continue, and you know trend lines are an exact science, then half the planet will be on Facebook by the end of the decade. Something is definitely happening here. I just want to give you a few sort of facts and figures to kind of frame the debate here. Facebook launched its Arabic language edition in, I believe, May 2009. By January 2010, there were 2 million people in Egypt on Facebook. Now, it's a country of about 80 million people, so maybe that wasn't a huge percentage. But, you see the jump in 1 year. By January 2011, there were 5 million people on Facebook in Egypt. 1 million of those on their mobile phones, which, of course, is an increasingly popular way to access it. There were thousands, literally thousands of groups, I think, in the last week of the revolution, Egyptian users created 32,000 groups and 14,000 pages on the surface. The group that started the initial protests in Tahrir Square had access to a Facebook group that grew, I think, eventually to 300,000 users. Now, maybe this did not actually cause the revolution. Of course, I believe, the will of the people is primary. That's what causes revolutions. But there are always other circumstances, and there are always different technologies involved. The Russian Revolution made great use of telegraphs, the train that brought Lenin to the Finland station. Technology is always involved, and we've heard a lot about Facebook as a platform for media, as a platform for discussion, as a platform for journalism even. I like to think of it as a platform for democracy. It's a lot of conversations, millions of conversations going on at once. It's kind of a cacophony. And I think that once you expose people to that kind of set of conversations, it's very hard to go back to the real world after you've been on it for 2 hours and realize that your voice is still being suppressed out there in the real world. So, not the trigger, but a trigger.
Stephen?
I just
Well, there's not much to disagree there. And in fact, it's rather interesting. The April 6th movement, which was played such a crucial role in the uprising, got its name from an uprising and a series of strikes and protests led by youth on April 6th, 2008, which they themselves called a Facebook revolution, because that's how they got the word out. And we saw both in Egypt and Tunisia how important it was in getting around official government censorship, which is critical in authoritarian societies, but also helping with the tactical coordination. At the same time, I do want to caution that we don't overstate it, because in my study of these kinds of nonviolent revolutions, that people find a way to communicate one way or the other, whether it be through pamphleteering, whether it be through cassette tapes, which was a way that they got the word out in the anti-Shah movement in the late 70s. In Mali, when they had the uprising against Traore in 1991, this was one of the poorest countries in the world. And they communicated using griots, the traditional sing-songy West African storytellers. The 1989 revolutions in Eastern Europe and so many of these others, you know, were before they had the internet, much less Facebook. So I think when people feel a need to communicate, they will find a way to communicate. And the nice thing about Facebook is that it makes it easier. But let's remember that in Egypt, the movement gained its greatest support during the 6 days when the internet was shut down. That only the 5 million is an important big number when we think of a country of 82 million. You know, that you know, vast majority of them have no internet access, you know, whatsoever. I think it again underscores that there are other ways of getting you know, getting people mobilized, getting people out. In fact, some of the people I knew in Cairo said that the shutting down the internet actually helped, because when people wanted to know what was going on, they couldn't find out through the internet. They couldn't trust regular media, so they had to go out and see it themselves. And they got they got caught up in the protest. So important as it is, let's not deny the human element and the desire to get the word out one way or the other.
We held two conferences right after the post Mubarak and post Ben Ali. In Tunisia on March 1st and in Egypt on March 7th, we brought journalists, bloggers, social media activists all around, you know, one table. And one thing struck me when we asked the young people, the ones who were demonstrating day in, day out, what kept you going? We asked the same question both in Tunisia and in Egypt, and they said the same thing. Because the world was watching. That's what they told us. Because everyone knew what we were doing. And that's what kept us going. And that's why we weren't afraid anymore. And this is really important about the power of information, whether it is Facebook, Twitter, wherever. I call them the multiplier, basically. I mean, they did not cause the revolution, but they certainly are the multiplier. And they kept the flow of information going, and that's where those young people drew their strength from. This is really important to remember.
Let's talk a little bit about U.S. foreign policy for a minute. Obviously, as the political map is quickly being redrawn in the region, you know, the U.S. is a little nervous. Where are we trending? Amongst the countries that we once called allies?
Well, unfortunately, the United States did not take quite the leadership that I was hoping, but that's not surprising given that the U.S. taxpayers have spent over $70 billion over the past 30 years to keep Mubarak in power, that it's been before he was a... before he was president, back when he was state senator. In fact, I remember Barack Obama saying very critical things about the Egyptian regime. Why are we supporting this guy, and et cetera? But as president, he had a very different policy. But for the record, despite Bush's pro-democracy rhetoric, he was at least as big a fan of friendly authoritarians and that friendly autocrats in that part of the world than any other president. But I think it's But to Obama's credit, though it was a little late, he did come in quite eloquently in terms of supporting the movement. And I think one thing that may have been critical is that he didn't call for Mubarak's removal explicitly, he did underscore the importance of civic space, allowing people to protest, reopening the internet, and getting the word that if the army was even thinking about a Tiananmen Square-type massacre, that they could forget about any further strategic cooperation or military aid from the United States. Personally, I doubt that would have happened anyway, because I don't think the soldiers would have obeyed orders if they were given that. But still, I think that was an important piece that Obama did. I think in the longer term, the fact is that a democratic Egypt, a democratic Arab world, is going to be nationalist. It's more nationalist. It's going to, because it's representing the people who want to put their needs, the country's needs, first. So they'll be less likely to cooperate with the United States than certain allied tyrants. They will take a more independent line. They will be less likely to cooperate with the dictates of the International Monetary Fund and other international financial institutions. And yet, I think in many ways it's the best thing for the United States, and I would add for Israel as well, because the fact is that people like Mohammed Atta, the Egyptian who was the chief hijacker in 9/11, and Zawahiri, and these folks that have risen in Al Qaeda and others, they tend not to come from democratic societies. They come from countries where people feel they cannot make change through established nonviolent means. And the more democracy there is, the less likely we'll see extremists, less likely will there be appeal of reactionary Islamist movements, the less appeal there will be for terror and the like. And I think in that sense, I think in the long term, it will be very good for U.S. Foreign policy, that it will mean a more secure Arab world that will not be subjected to nearly as vulnerable to extremist ideologies.
If I may interrupt, I'm going to keep my talking to. I'm going to limit my talking because I'm not nearly as credible as these people over here. But one thing to point out, which was a very key, what you saw happening in Egypt, the common sentiment on the ground was, you had media coverage 24/7 happening, and then after 8 or so days, you found, oh, what is the U.S.? What's the U.S. going to do after it loses its largest ally? What's Israel going to do, losing its largest and key ally in that region? What people were saying on the ground is, U.S., Israel, this is not about you. For once, this is not about you. Let us bask in our own glory and our celebrations right now. Let us fix our country, unlike some people would argue the U.S. would have to deal with locally what they need to do, and then going, reaching out into Afghanistan, into Iraq. We need to fix ourselves first before we go about and worry about our foreign relations. Although that is important, and it's a very credible question, I think, here, given that we are in the U.S., people were really, guys, this isn't about you. After 8 days of 24/7 coverage, it turned into the U.S., and it's not about you, guys.
So, since the days of the revolution began, and since the ouster of former President Mubarak, as Ayman had pointed out, Egypt is at a very, very critical moment in defining the further steps that it needs to take to reach democracy, a true democracy. So, Noor, on that point, what is the fixing, sort of on a day-to-day basis, is it that needs to happen?
So, this is my personal opinion. What we started seeing is suddenly right after the revolution, you started finding so many people jobless, people in between jobs, people, banks who have jobs, they're just actual jobs, aren't open. So you find these people have this endless time on their hands, and then at the same time, they're feeling very empowered. So you have, what we have to note is that a majority of the country is uneducated. So it's hard enough for people in this room who are educated and people like us to hypothesize what the country needs, how we need to reform it economically, and just in these macro kind of ways, how we need to reform the country. 70% of the population is not eligible to do so. The way I really think about it, and this would be ideal, I think, in Egypt, and I think for humans, for everybody all around the world, is Egyptians are skilled artisans. We don't have something, we build it.
we figure out ways. There's always a way. The ambulances don't make it to the scenes. It's the actual people that get down and help out when there's an accident. So what individuals need to do is go home and ask themselves, from the mechanic to the bus driver to the banker to any civilian, any citizen in Egypt, is go back home and write down in a journal or whatever how your day-to-day life can be improved, not how the overall country needs to be reformed and what type of leader, how you personally. And they will talk for days about that. The mechanic will know exactly what he needs from his day-to-day. Same with the guy, with the truck driver. He will know what needs to be changed, his passengers, about prices, about gas, about natural gas, how to install it, repair shops. All of that is people, I urge people to stop thinking macro, stop thinking like that. You need to start on a day-to-day basis. And that's when you start seeing groups and labor groups and everybody forming is a lot more focused. We need a lot more focused initiatives happening on the ground. And you see that with the youth, but then you see people sitting, oh, I'm going to sit and talk about this and think that they're it's very hard for any intellect to do that, to hypothesize. So I think we need to be very detailed and focused as to what we need to reform. And nobody knows that than in your own profession, that person themselves. So,
you know, if the days of the pre-Mubarak, I guess, if the days before Mubarak was ousted were marked by unity and cohesion, you know, certainly the days after the ouster have been anything but, has not been marked by cohesion. People on a daily basis are still going to Tahrir Square with their individual demands of the government that is currently being formed. Is there a sense as to what it is the nation wants and needs in a democracy?
I think it's very important to remember that the first 3 days of the uprising, the people who went to Tahrir Square, they weren't demanding the ouster of Mubarak. I mean, this is really important. They were asking for freedom, accountability, end of corruption. And when their demands were not met, this is on the third day they started chanting the slogan, "Ash-Sha'b yurid isqat al-nizam," which means the people want to see the end of the regime. This was after 3 days. It happened organically because what they were asking is for basically their basic human rights. And when they were denied, they realized they had to continue. So now this is an organic movement. Every day something changes on the ground. And one thing, it's a little bit unique because you have on one hand the youth who are the driving force behind what happened, but at the same time you have the military who are in control and they've been negotiating. I mean, something again Ayman referred to, revolutions, they take 3 steps forward and they fall back 2 steps. And we have to remember, we could have all this euphoria, but the fact of the matter, the military is still in control. And the military, they've promised that they're going to have elections in 6 months. But I don't remember in history when military juntas were so eager to hand over power. So we have to wait and see, really, because a lot of things can happen within the next 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Dan.
Yeah, Jamal, if I can also break in on this. When Ayman mentioned that the square was cleared the other day by the military, and this was the first time they had done that. In fact, it was not the first time they had done it, and it's part of the ambiguity that I think Jamal's referring to. When I was detained, which was before Mubarak left, it was a period when the military was trying to find a way to clear the square. And one way they were trying to do it was to dry up the support network outside the square. So I happened, like Inspector Clouseau, to have walked into a human rights office in the middle of a raid and got handcuffed and taken away for 36 hours. They did it. They tried it again on February 26th when they, after midnight, I believe it was Saturday after midnight, the military went in and tore down tents. People were just bedding down for the night and chased people with sticks, used electric prods to scatter them from the square and from a small sit-in in front of Parliament. And they also arrested, at least one of the demonstrators who was arrested was put on military trial, secret, tried in 10 minutes without a lawyer, and sentenced to 5 years in jail for breaking curfew, something that everyone who drinks tea in Cairo does, and for assaulting a soldier, which was very unlikely for an unarmed young man. And now they've cleared, using the pretext apparently of sectarian problems, they've cleared the square again. From the human rights point of view, again, what Jamal said was for the first few days they wanted their freedoms and they weren't given and they got rid of Mubarak. Now they've gotten rid of Mubarak and the question still remains, are they going to get their freedoms? An end to the daily humiliations of having documents asked for, of plainclothes people being able to shake you down for money or just take you away from a police station, or to be tried by military trial, which is allowed under the emergencies law, which Human Rights Watch but other organizations in Egypt want ended. Are these? It's the system now that's at stake, not a person. Everyone was able to unite around, okay, let's get rid of Hosni Mubarak. That's an easy thing to unite around. These other things which are coming up, which divide society, are going to be part of the democratic fabric of Egypt if it happens. But will a system be created without torture, without arbitrary jailings, with open and free elections? This really remains to be seen.
With Mubarak out, what has changed thus far? Dan?
Well, it's plenty. I gave a sort of a downbeat assessment of things. The secret policemen that I mentioned are not on the street anymore. Even a foreigner like me who used to spend a lot of time downtown got to know them by their face. And it was once, and I suppose technically still is, for an Egyptian to speak to a foreigner unless he had a license from the tourist ministry. So I could be talking to Noor on Tahrir Square before the revolution, and some guy could come up and ask for Noor's documents and haul him away on these grounds alone. Of course, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, this is a vast change. The idea that before demonstrations in Egypt, which had been going on for the past 6 or 5 years, 50, 200 people. I mean, this release of the tension of the police state is quite noticeable there, and that's a big change.
Jamal?
The one thing that you notice now when you go again to Cairo, not just at Tahrir Square, is the empowerment of youth. And what I'm trying to say, when you go to any corner of the streets now, you have youth taking charge of traffic, cleaning the streets, removing graffiti, helping the elderly, helping people at hospitals. I mean, there is so much energy because you asked the question, what has changed? And to me, this is what really has changed, is just to see all that youth energy all over. In fact, when I was there, I visited the American University in Cairo, and they've taken down all the advertisements there and replaced them with civic society slogans, how to help your country, how to get involved, how to volunteer. I mean, there is that sense of an energy that has taken over the entire city.
And if I may build on that, that's an energy that seems to be taking over the entire Middle East. Mm-hmm. The kind of a popular empowerment that, I mean, the feelings of fatalism and hopelessness that we'll forever be victims of these dictators or Western imperialism or whatever, and that sense that people can do it themselves, and I think it's changed our attitudes as well, not only has Al-Qaeda's whole thesis been disproved, that the only way to overthrow U.S.-backed dictators is through terrorism and extremism. And remember, Al-Qaeda's first attack against U.S. interests was in the Dhofar Towers bombing, where U.S. forces were training Saudi internal security units. That not only has it disproved their thesis that terrorism is the only way to make change, it's also challenged the whole neocon idea that you need the United States or some Western power to come and invade and overthrow these dictators, and we can somehow install democracy, from above. And of course, we've seen how well that's worked in Iraq, especially since they're now gunning down pro-democracy protesters and the like, and that. I mean, I think it's shown that it's not through foreign invasion, not through armed struggle, not through sanctimonious statements from Washington, not from trusting some benign leader, but the people themselves, that are the ultimately the agents of change. And while I'm as cynical about the intentions of the Egyptian military as anybody. I'm pretty hopeful, simply for the ideas. I don't think the Egyptian people tolerate anything but a genuine democratic transition. We may see hundreds of thousands of people in the streets again. We may have to see it on quite a number of occasions in the coming weeks and months. But I think there has really been a profound psychological and social change just in terms of people's attitudes about their own role in history.
What was the role of women in the revolution?
I think they had a major role to play in the revolution, and I actually fault the media, although I'm a member of it, or a former member of it, for not highlighting this, because if you watch most of the photographs or the television footage, somehow, maybe in the West, they love to show angry young men, right? So most of the revolutions, whether in Tunisia or in Egypt, we always see these men there, chanting or being angry, and they totally ignore showing the woman. And the woman, in fact, whether in Egypt or in Tunisia, they played a major role in assembly, in sending the message, in the communication aspect. But somehow they are invisible in the media, and this is terribly wrong. Something terrible in this picture. I think they played a role. But the discussion, maybe the question should be asked whether what kind of a role they're going to play in the future. For example, in Tunisia, when they changed the government or starting to change the government, only one woman was appointed to the ministry. So that's the sad part. They've participated, yet they haven't reaped the results.
Dan, before you answer, just really quickly, we're going to be taking your questions in about 5 minutes, so please start lining up at the mic now. And back to Dan.
Yes, sir. Just briefly, Jamal, they did have a role. Their post-Mubarak role, or in Tunisia, post-Ben Ali roles, is definitely in question. There was an effort on Women's Day a couple of days ago to have a march for women to march into Tahrir, to demand equal rights, and the account, I wasn't there, so I don't. The accounts I read were when they were saying things like, a woman can be president of Egypt too. They were insulted by gangs of men. Egypt, maybe less than Tunisia, has a major problem with the social problem of the woman's place in society. There's things that didn't exist in Egypt 20, 30 years ago: groping in public streets, accosting women in really awful ways. Became kind of endemic in the last few years. And then this small incident, anecdotal, nonetheless suggested, despite the fact they were in Tahrir Square, shoulder to shoulder with the men, that now there's lots of men in Egypt who would like them back home and making the tea.
I also just wanted to add that women have played a major role in other struggles going on around the Middle East and have historically. In fact, for those of you interested in this topic in general, there's an excellent anthology that came out about a year ago called Civilian Jihad: Nonviolent Struggle, Democratization, and Governance in the Middle East. I contributed a couple chapters, as well as quite a few other folks, primarily Middle Easterners. And there are a number of chapters that look at the role of women in these movements, from Turkey to Palestine to Western Sahara. In fact, in Western Sahara, the territory occupied by Morocco, women like Aminatou Haidar are actually in the leadership of the nonviolent struggle for independence. And one of the important aspects of nonviolent struggles is that it's not something that is centered by able-bodied young men, that women can get involved, older people can get involved. It brings a much broader segment of society out, and it also makes it more likely that the post-revolutionary regime will be more democratic, because instead of having these martial values and elite vanguard like you see in armed struggles, you have to build the coalitions. You have to bring in men and women, young and old, people from various sectoral parts of society, Christian and Muslim, et cetera. So I think that women's participation certainly does not guarantee women's leadership. I think it's an important prerequisite.
I'd like to add one thing on the Facebook
Chris,
statistics.
Sorry.
The While it is true that the majority of Facebook users in Egypt are men, 60%, women are the proportion of women is growing fast. And actually, in Egypt, as well as the rest of the world, the fastest growing group is women over 60. It's a very exciting statistic. And in fact, I believe that the protest that you mentioned in Cairo was organized by a women's group on Facebook. So, you know, developments to come.
So, Noor, one last question before we open it up to the audience. As a young Egyptian who, born and raised in Cairo, you have family there. You were there 2 days prior to the revolution. You're going to be going back in 2 days. As a young Egyptian, what are your hopes for the country in the next year?
Change it within the next year. That changes within over my lifetime. Within the next year, okay, this is, again, my opinion. That's all I have to offer. But something that we should have started working on and we need to start tomorrow is we have never, since the days of the pharaohs, we have never had transparent democratic elections. Egyptians are completely ignorant on how to vote. They have never voted in their life. Maybe they voted for something in their classroom, but never gone and officially gone to ballots and done so. What Egyptians need to start working on is educating or civil society groups. There's over 30,000 registered civil society groups in Egypt. All of them, although equally important, whatever work they do, is shift a little bit of their efforts to actually engage in educating the Egyptian people how to monitor the upcoming elections, how to participate, where to go to the ballots, where to go to register, how to actually fill out the ballot, how to have civic society actually represented in the Electoral Commission. People need to start getting and rising together, and actually every single Egyptian needs to now know how to vote so that eventually we don't have somebody that came into power and he's just another, it's a different face but the same kind of regime. We do not want that. So everybody will have nobody but to blame but themselves if they don't participate in this upcoming September elections. So that's my two cents. And one more thing, if I may, in relation to women, when you said the roles of women, yes, I feel that there are systems of oppression and stuff you have in the country, and that's worldwide. But at the end of the day, it's a Muslim society and it's a patriarchal society. What needs to change is not so much the systems, but it's an internal revolution. Males need to change the way they think and view females and the roles of women, and that's for the betterment of how women partake in civil society in the future.
Great, thank you. Okay, so we're going to go and open this up to audience questions. As a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's Inform program, and tonight we're discussing Egypt and the Middle East Revolutions 2.0. I am Adam Yamaguchi, correspondent and executive producer for Current TV's Vanguard series, and I'm here with Jamal Dajani, vice president of the Middle East, North Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean at Internews Network, Stephen Zunes, professor of politics and chair of Middle Eastern studies at the University of San Francisco, Chris Taylor, San Francisco bureau chief at Mashable, Dan Williams, senior emergencies researcher at Human Rights Watch, and Noor Ahmadeen, senior at the University of San Francisco, born and raised in Cairo. Now we're going to go to the audience for questions for about 15 minutes. If you could step up to the mic. One question, please. Go right to the question. And if you want to address anyone specific, please do so.
I'll just throw it at the group. I'm wondering, Tunisia, Egypt, and a lot of other stuff that's happening right now, we're very much people-powered. We're talking about a no-fly zone in Libya, which would be potentially really significant foreign intervention. As well intended as it would be, probably innocent people would get killed in that. It's a violent situation right now. So I'm wondering if you could comment on the potential effects of foreign intervention in Libya and maybe tomorrow being the sort of planned day of rage in Saudi Arabia, Libya going differently so far than Tunisia and Egypt. What might happen there with a really scary regime?
Jamal,
just quickly, as far as foreign intervention in Libya, I'll say it very simple. This is what Gaddafi wants. I mean, this is really what he wants now. So any kind of intervention will just prolong the misery, even the no-fly zone, as much as it saddens me to see the attacks on civilians. But we can have a scenario like to what happened when we pretty much prolonged the existence of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. I'm totally against foreign intervention at this point. Remember the success in Tunisia and in Egypt happened from within and organically. And this hopefully will happen in Libya.
I think it's rather striking that there's a international security, which is the mainstream, most prominent journal in the field, had an article about 2 years ago, I guess, when they looked at 300 cases of revolutions against dictators or foreign occupation armies or colonialism or whatever. And they found that armed struggle was successful 23% of the time, but primarily nonviolent struggle successful 52% of the time, more than twice as much. And the biggest gains of the Libyan Revolution was in the first week when it was nonviolent. That's when they took over most of the country. And it's when they tried to take up arms, meeting Gaddafi at his strongest point, was that it was when things started going really bad. And I reject the idea, Gaddafi is so ruthless, it can't work. But let's remember that Ben Ali ordered his troops to massacre, to fire on the protesters in Tunis. And the head of the armed forces said he wasn't going to do that because he knew the soldiers wouldn't obey, and that's when Ben Ali fled. Similarly, the Marcos in the Philippines, Honecker in East Germany, they made the orders to massacre people, and people didn't do it. So I think it's always a dilemma when things get to this level about intervention. I'm not against the idea of humanitarian intervention or a so-called responsibility to protect in principle, but it'd have to get pretty close to genocide before I think it would end up being doing more good than harm for the very reasons that Jamal mentioned.
Okay, thank you, Stephen. Next question, please.
Recently in my AP government class,
because we have a lot of people who want to ask questions, if you can just go straight to your question, that'd be great.
We were looking at the Green Movement in Iran from 2009, and I wanted to ask you, it seems like there's very similar situations in Iran that there were in Egypt and Tunisia and so forth, of young people wanting to get out and wanting to let their voice be heard. And I wanted to ask you, the panel, what you thought could trigger a similar movement in Iran if it was at all possible under President Ahmadinejad's rule.
Well, I think Dan. There is a difference. I'm not sure I'll answer your question, but I think there is a difference. Iran, there's a split in the ruling class that has in some way is reflected in the street. And one of the things that Ahmadinejad uses, but also the rulers of Bahrain, is to pit partisans of each side against each other. So part of the problem in Iran is that when, and also this happens in Lebanon to some extent, when the Green Movement comes out, Ahmadinejad can also send out his people, and they create a kind of balance of fright between them. So it's not exactly the same in Egypt, which it had there was no party connection here. It wasn't ordained from the top. It wasn't sponsored by anyone at the top, as far as I can see. So I don't know if you can make an analogy. I'm not answering your question, but I don't think you can actually compare Egypt to Iran.
Okay, next question, please.
Hi. My question is for Dr. Zunes, but if other members of the panel would like to add on, that would be great. I lived in Egypt for 2 years. I work with the national team of the country, soccer team. I was there about a year ago, and it's known that the Mubarak regime has for several decades motivated that sectarian violence among Christians and Muslims. And I thought it was very interesting that during the movement in Tahrir Square, you saw Christians around Muslims protecting them while they were praying, and you also saw Muslims protecting Christians while they were praying. So my question is, there's been, it's kind of surprising to me that it has not really been mentioned. I haven't seen any reports in the mainstream media here in the United States about the role that the Interior Minister, Habib al-Adli, had in actually the bombings in Alexandria. Yeah. And, you know, that is something that is very important, because it would show and it would prove that for years this government has been actually, you know, promoting and causing this division in order to entrench themselves in power and justify their position. So, you know,
can you get to the question?
And as I wanted them to comment on that and bring that to the attention of the panel, because I think it's very important, because during the next few months, you know, each of us is going through some very critical times, and nobody really knows what's going to happen.
Yeah. Let's get Stephen.
Divide and rule is classic. You know, I have seen the evidence to suggest the Interior Ministry is indeed behind it. And I think one of the big crucial things, along with ensuring free and fair elections and ensuring civic space, is transparency. To find out some of these dirty deeds, including the deliberate efforts to divide Christians from Muslims. And it's not the end of sectarian conflicts, as we've just seen tragically in the past day, but I think for the things that you mentioned, that coming of unity together is a very, very hopeful sign.
Great. Next question, please.
Yes, thank you. So what I've heard is, you know, keeping the West out of the fight, and I certainly understand that. And has that meant physically, financially, or both?
Dan?
Out of the fight where?
In the Middle East.
Well, there's an irony in that for all of Obama's diffidence toward democratic movements in the Middle East and elsewhere, and for instance in Egypt, he withdrew money directly given to independent NGOs and funded all through the government, that all this should happen on his watch. It's not to his credit. Maybe there's some sort of like weird fable here that when the Americans, it doesn't rely on the Americans, that their rhetorical stand doesn't really count as much. So certainly in Egypt, they have to stand back. Libya is going to be more of a problem because civilians could get, there could be a threshold where this responsibility to protect, which is not a quite fully formed tenet of international law, could come into play where Western powers or other powers would have to or would think they'd have to intervene. So it could happen.
Thank you.
Also,
thank you.
Too, I think just fiscally, physically, militarily, they do need to stay out because the series of revolutions we've been seeing are very volatile, fragile, and unpredictable. So something that was on the ground in Egypt was people didn't want any political party. Even though supportive of the revolution, they didn't want any el-Baradai or the West or anybody else to come and hijack a revolution that was truly organic. Same thing with all that will almost go in vain in Libya if you have Western interference and then they become liberated after that. The people will not feel as empowered and it won't truly be organic. So I think as of now, all of that.
All right, we're down to the last 4 minutes. Quick question, quick answer, please.
Yes, since the American Revolution, every revolutionary sister, with exceptions such as the Eastern Bloc when the Soviet Union broke up, has ended up with a regime that's as undemocratic or as repressive, if not more so, than the regime that they placed. So is this going to happen here, and how does one prevent such an event?
Well, for reasons I mentioned, that the nonviolent revolutions have a much higher track record in terms of ensuring a democratic future. Indeed, it's striking that 70 of the 70 or so countries that have gone from dictatorship to some degree of democracy in the past 30 years, close to three quarters of them did so. Not from armed struggle or foreign intervention or voluntary changes from above, but from democratic civil society organizations engaged in strategic nonviolent action. And I think it's that kind of the best best way to ensure a democratic transition is to have these broad-based movements that build broad coalitions that engage in nonviolent struggle, that bring in the diverse elements of society. And again, I think there's a lot still that needs to be done. I think Egypt and Tunisia are definitely heading in a more democratic direction.
Okay, next question, please.
I'd like to know among all the demonstrators at the square, how many of those are uneducated, who are poor, who had no access to internet, who cannot afford a cell phone, what kind of role they played? Thank you.
Well, most of Egypt is poor, and most of the feet on the ground eventually were poorer people. But it must be said that all classes were represented there. It wasn't an elite thing, and it wasn't just an uprising of the poor.
All right, one last question.
It's my understanding that there's zero police force out in Egypt right now, and security is, you know, causing some locals to become nervous and grow weary from all of the unrest. And I was wondering how you feel that will affect the momentum of the revolution.
Jamal. It's true. I mean, at least up to a couple of weeks ago, they started to bring back the police force, but you had national and citizens who kind of were monitoring everything there, protecting their own neighborhoods. I think the army also managed to secure the major installations in Cairo and keep things at peace. Eventually, I think they're going to reinstate the police force, even though many of them were corrupt, because you cannot go through the same experience to what had happened in Iraq, the de-ba'athification, I mean, of the military. You cannot just fire an entire police force.
Okay, thank you so much. Unfortunately, that's going to wrap up the question portion of this discussion. It is the newly founded Inform tradition of 2011 that we are asking all of our speakers the following question. Panelists, what is your 60-second idea to change the world? And because we're running short on time, you have 30 seconds. Starting with Jamal.
Well, I'll say something about what we do in the Middle East, which is really empowering local media. I mean, this is the most important thing, keeping the flow of information. And if I had one wish to happen in the Middle East, I would abolish every single ministry of information.
Stephen.
I think it's to recognize and participate in the power of nonviolent action, not out of a pacifist principle or spiritual or moral, but simply because it works. And I think and that is the road to democracy in the Middle East and elsewhere. And I would quickly add that given the United States remains the world's number one supporter of dictatorships around the world, I think we need more strategic nonviolent action here to change that policy to help promote democracy around the world.
Chris Taylor.
Complete freedom of information. The protesters in Egypt were able to download information from the internet on how to surround riot police by coming at them from different angles, how to survive tear gas. We need that information out there. We need more connections on the internet, and we need the world to keep watching. We need to get rid of this notion that Americans are not interested in foreign news, because we all are when it matters. You know, we watch it on Twitter, we watch it on Facebook. So, you know, keep watching.
Dan Williams.
Yeah, I just hope one of these uprisings works, because none of them yet are guaranteed. And of those, I think Egypt is the key. It's the biggest country. It has also kind of mythical status in the Middle East. So if Egypt gets rid of torture and Egypt gets rid of arbitrary arrest and Egypt has free elections, then really the world will change quite a bit.
Noor?
Please, cab driver, stop blasting Quran while we ride in the cabs. Stop drinking so many cups of tea throughout the day. My real point, civil society stand up. If you are jobless, now you have a job. The revolution should and will employ you. If you don't have a job, it's your duty to make this your part-time job in reforming the country.
Great, thank you.
Let's talk about tech.
Well, let's continue to give a big round of applause to our panel for sharing their thoughts with us tonight. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.